All right, both sides ready? Okay, if you call the last case of the day.
The court will now call Robert O'Brien versus the state of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. Richard Gladden will argue for the appellant. Ms. Laura Tomlin will argue for the state.
Okay, Richard?
Yes, may it please the court. Good afternoon. I feel like today must be Denton County Day because I know an associate of mine was here this morning
that.
And everybody else this afternoon is a Denton County case.
And we had somebody from El Paso. We had somebody from Dallas. We had somebody from Austin. So.
Okay, well, I wasn't here for that, so I guess.
I don't think we've had anybody from Fort Worth, have we?
And this appeal is relatively straightforward and simple. We've raised two issues on appeal. One is that the stop or detention of my client violated the Fourth Amendment, and it was a warrantless stop, and therefore the state bore the burden not only in the trial court but on appeal to the extent that that's a question of law, or mixed question of law and fact that would be considered de novo. The second issue we have is one really of statutory construction under Article 3823, and whether or not there is or is not a good faith exception as a matter of statutory construction when there is no warrant underlying or preceding the detention. I think the state and the defendant or appellant here are in agreement that the trial court did err on that second issue and that it found in its order that the motion to suppress should be denied based upon a good faith exception to the exclusionary rule, which just does not exist under the statutory provision, Article 3823, Texas law. We have abandoned any claim that there was a requirement for suppression under the federal exclusionary rule, which under some circumstances would allow admissibility without a warrant for a violation of the Fourth Amendment. So I'm going to start out talking more specifically about the actual Fourth Amendment violation, and then turn to just briefly discussing later.
So I'm clear to start with, you're not challenging the scope of the search or that it was a greater intrusion that was necessary, are you?
The manner of the search, no. And I know the state mentioned that. Of course, I do think that the nature of the stop obviously should be considered, and that this was not a routine traffic stop, as the officer indicated. It was a felony stop. He shut down the highway, approached my client's vehicle with his gun drawn, and forcibly removed my client at gunpoint from his vehicle. And I think that's something that the court probably should, when the state starts saying they have a legitimate governmental purpose in finding possibly stolen vehicles, I think there probably is some balancing in there with regard to the facts of this case, because it is a greater intrusion in the balance than ordinarily would happen at a routine traffic stop. But moving to the Fourth Amendment question, what we're talking about here is a situation where the collective knowledge, or some courts call it the fellow officer doctrine, is seen to play both ways. We know from the Hensley decision in the U.S. Supreme Court that Fourth Amendment analysis, an officer in the field will not violate the Fourth Amendment when he relies upon a police dispatch of a wanted flyer or detention flyer of some sort, but only so long as the information in possession of the agency that transmits the confirmation of a flyer or wanted bulletin at that time holds reasonable suspicion for the stop. In this case, there is no dispute that the vehicle that was reported by the Denton Police Department to continue to be stolen at the time of my client's stop, they had records and they knew that the vehicle had been recovered 5 months earlier in September of 2012, and through error, either by the officer who knew firsthand and facilitated the recovery of the vehicle from the towing company, or the dispatcher that he requested that the NCIC or TCI report be withdrawn, failed. We know it was an error between those two individuals. We also know that the City of Denton Police Department, for reasons I don't understand, does not allow the dispatchers, whose ultimate duty it is to withdraw these NCIC alerts from the computer, does not have access to an electronic database, the RMS system, that the investigating officers place the information into. And so what we're talking about in exclusion, federal exclusionary law, of course, it is relevant whether a mistake is deliberate or reckless and things of that nature. But that is not the same analysis that you're looking for a Fourth Amendment violation, which is just the objective reasonableness of the action. We don't dispute that when that report of the vehicle being stolen, originally when it was stolen, was supported by reasonable suspicion, and my client's father, as a matter of fact, was the one that reported it stolen. But the information that the Denton Police Department got after that placed them under a duty to disclose or to take action to withdraw that warrant once they knew 100% in this case that the vehicle had been recovered. Under the collective knowledge doctrine, it works both ways, is that an officer without knowledge, personal knowledge of the facts, can rely on the information so long as the information coming from the agency that puts out the wanted flyer at that time supports reasonable suspicion. It works the reverse of that as well, is that at the time of the stop, an officer actually will violate. He's probably got some kind of, I know he's got immunity from any kind of civil liability under Section 1983, but if you get to the core question of a constitutional violation, if the agency, who through their error, an objectively unreasonable error, causes that detention based upon their error and not with recalling the warrant, or their error in having a system where their dispatcher can't see the information showing that it's been recalled or should have been recalled, that is a constitutional violation. And I think, and we've
talking also about imputed knowledge?
That's basically what you're talking about. Under the Hensley, and I think even before that, with the Whiteley decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, is we live, and that was an older case, probably in the 40s, where the use of radio broadcasting was, of course, nationwide by that time, and they had to make a decision under what circumstances could an officer not violate the Fourth Amendment, even though he did not personally know the facts. And so it's called the collective knowledge doctrine. There's a long series of chapters, as a matter of fact, in the legal treaties we cite.
No, by imputed knowledge, I meant the fact that one officer knew the warrant or whatever it was had been recalled, that knowledge was imputed to the other officers in that.
Under the collective knowledge, it is. And I cite a number of cases. I did not see any Texas decision of law directly on point. Most of them talk about a federal exclusionary rule. A number of the decisions cited by the trial court, again, we're dealing with the federal exclusionary rule there, federal cases. And so what we've got here is, number one, just the core question of whether a Fourth Amendment violation occurred. There is one of the better or more, I think, better analysis actually was written in a New York Supreme Court case that was authored by Judge Scheinlin, who I hope his legal reasoning is not diminished too much by the fact that Judge Judy is his wife. but what he said was basically that it was inexcusable for them, in fact, exactly like this, really, not to, they could have cured the problem in two ways. Number one, they could have not released the vehicle until they were certain that the information showing it was wanted was recovered, was withdrawn. Of course, in the first instance, they could have just done it there at the time the vehicle was recovered and returned to the owner. If for some reason they have some technical difficulty in getting through to Washington or the FBI or whoever it is to take it off the NCIC, it's the reasonable thing to do would be not to release that vehicle until they could ensure that wanted flyer for the vehicle had been withdrawn. Instead, you've got a situation where once the error has occurred, I don't know that they should have a duty to check every 3 months or 4 months retroactively to see if a vehicle has been recovered. They knew it was recovered. And in fact, this violation would be no different than after my client's arrest in this case, they still didn't take it or withdraw it from the computer system. They could make the same argument on a third or a second arrest of my client the next day or a week later or 6 months later and just say, gosh, there is an NCIC flyer. Sure, we had it in our records, but our records are kind of hard to find. The dispatchers don't have access to them. And I think what we're really talking about is just objective reasonableness. And I cite two cases by the U.S. Supreme Court, Maryland versus Garrison, as well as another one that says that there actually is, under the reasonableness requirement of the Fourth Amendment, there is a continuing duty for an officer to take action after justification for a stop or even issuance of a warrant has been established in the past. In Maryland versus Garrison, it talks about an officer who reasonably conducted an investigation and could not discern that it was actually two dwellings inside of one building as opposed to one. And he got a warrant to search one building at one address. And only after entering the building did he discover that he had two, if he did discover that he had two separate habitations, then he would have had a constitutional duty to limit his search. That's the constitutional duty that I think was imposed upon Officer Landolf and whoever that dispatcher was on duty at that time, one or both of them, to ensure that warrant was recalled, and their failure to do so was objectively unreasonable. The state has the burden to show that it was reasonable, and they failed to do so in the trial court. The second issue we have is, of course, as I said, a matter of statutory construction. The Article 3823 says that if you have a violation of the federal constitution, the evidence obtained as a result of that violation is not admissible in trial. That's subparagraph A. Subparagraph B creates an exception, a good faith exception, but only in cases where the stop or detention or search is based upon a warrant issued upon probable cause. Nobody claims in this case, and the state does not dispute, that there was no warrant that preceded this detention. And therefore, I can only analyze the trial court's decision that there was a good faith exception in this case to its reliance on the federal exclusionary rule, because there is no exclusionary rule under Article 3823 unless there's a warrant. I think it's just as clear as it can be in that case, in this case, that there was a Fourth Amendment violation. And for that reason, the trial court erred by not entering an order suppressing the evidence that was obtained as a result of the detention. Now, the state did say a number of things. They've got one argument that they cite a number of cases where discovering that something is erroneous after the fact is relevant to this case. That's not what this case is about. It's the discovery beyond reasonable doubt of what the fact is, that the vehicle's not stolen anymore, that was known to prior to the detention. We're not claiming a situation where the only information available under the collective knowledge doctrine indicated or even justified a reasonable belief that the vehicle was stolen. We're talking about the opposite, and that after the fact, finding out that it really wasn't. They knew before this detention, under the collective knowledge doctrine, that the vehicle was no longer stolen, had been recovered, had been returned to his father. And I think this is an important case, not only because there's not a lot of decision law on it in Texas. Of course, there is a whole chapter or more of it in the legal treaties that I cite in my brief. And there's a number of decisions, pretty much a consensus among courts that have addressed the Fourth Amendment issue, that we're correct on it, that the facts of this case do establish a Fourth Amendment violation. I think it's important because if you allow police departments to conduct themselves the way they do in this case, you've got all kinds of citizens out there that through no fault of their own are being exposed to what is called a dynamic felony stop, where guns are drawn, the highway's shut down, they're pulled out of a car without an opportunity to even know what they're being pulled over for. And although my client was found to be in possession of some prescription pills that belonged to his mother, I think in weighing the thing out, this would not be an egregious case where a real serious criminal offender is able to escape on a technicality. I don't want to be pulled over at gunpoint because the Denton Police Department makes unreasonable errors and maybe it's a little bit sloppy about how they do their work. And so I would request that the trial court's order and final judgment be reversed and this case be remanded to the trial court. One other thing, because this ruling occurred before our negotiated plea, there is no harm analysis that's appropriate, and that's the McKenna decision, which I also cite in my brief. Thank you.
With that, let me ask you one question, Mr. Gladden. Without getting into the actual what happened out there on the road that day and whether that was reasonable or not reasonable, is it your position that if you have a police department and you have one person on that police department who made an error and didn't cause the right entry that showed that the car had been returned. But everybody else on that police department believes that, in fact, the car is still stolen, that under the collective knowledge doctrine, that is enough to not provide reasonable suspicion or
No, it would be an absence of reasonable suspicion. Right. The burden is on them to show reasonable suspicion. If you show one person knew conclusively that that vehicle was not stolen, he had a duty to disclose that information, an affirmative duty to disclose that information, and take such actions as would prevent a Fourth Amendment violation. That's an ongoing duty under the reasonableness requirement of the Fourth Amendment. That's why I discuss Maryland versus Garrison. The fact that there may once have been probable cause or reasonable suspicion doesn't mean that they can turn a blind eye. Even a single officer can turn a blind eye and be the direct cause of a seizure thereafter that isn't supported by reasonable suspicion or probable cause. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The state will start by addressing the 3823 argument. The trial court's ruling should be upheld under any theory of law if it's supported by the record. So I think the main issue in this case is the Fourth Amendment and the stop, because if the stop isn't valid under the Fourth Amendment, the state doesn't think we'd win under 3823, because this isn't a warrant. It would be under 3823A. So I think this case is all about the Fourth Amendment, and this case is all about the reasonableness of the stop. And it was reasonable for Officer Thornton to rely on the NCIC information. It was reasonable for him to check with dispatch to make sure the information in NCIC was correct according to dispatch. It was reasonable for dispatch to check their paper records. And thus, it was reasonable for them to stop and investigate what NCIC said was a stolen vehicle. The mistake by Officer Landolfo or the dispatch person he spoke to should not invalidate this stop. Collective knowledge should not apply to this, as the collective knowledge cases, Dirschweiler and Hogue, and they talk about the collective knowledge is the cumulative information known to the cooperating officers at the time of the stop. At the time of this stop, it was Officer Thornton, an Argyle PD officer, a DPS officer, and Ms. Kilbrew from dispatch that were working together on this case. Officer Thornton is not even work for Denton Police Department. He works for Northlake, and I imagine Northlake contracts with Denton to use their dispatch just because Northlake's a very small city with maybe a few officers. But Officer Landolfo, who knew that the car wasn't stolen, had nothing to do with this case. And it was reasonable for Officer Thornton to rely on this NCIC information. As stated in my brief, the NCIC, it's pretty, it's in agreement that NCIC information can be relied upon if it's based on reasonable suspicion.
And Excuse me. There's a case, I can't remember the style of it. You can always tell when somebody's an old lawyer, they can remember a case but can't remember the style. It had to do with getting a confession from a defendant. He was in one jurisdiction. The lawyer, the officers in a different jurisdiction knew he had a lawyer, and he had no lawyer in the second county where they got his confession. And the appellate courts imputed the knowledge of the officers in the county where they knew he had a lawyer to the officers in the county where he made his confession. And so it would seem to me to stand for the principle that they don't have to be in the same police department for the knowledge of one officer to be imputed to the others.
I'll admit I'm not familiar with that case, but I would say that this case is different, because in that case it's a confession, and in this case we're just talking about reasonable suspicion to pull over a vehicle.
Other than the NCIC notice, was there anything else in the record that provided grounds for the stop?
No, I don't think there was. I could be wrong about this, but I think it was a license plate check, and it came up stolen, and that's how it got started. I don't believe there was any other reason to pull him over. Going back to the NCIC, Brown v. State, 1999, out of Dallas, it held that it's not necessary for NCIC to be accurate on every occasion to establish probable cause. And here, we're not even talking about probable cause, we're talking about reasonable suspicion. And in Lissy v. State, out of Houston, that case now would be overturned most recently about with like McNeely and the recent Court of Criminal Appeals case about getting blood on third DWIs, but in that case there was an inaccurate second DWI on NCIC, and they got the person's blood, and the court upheld it, saying it wasn't a glaring contradiction or facially unreliable that it said DWI second. So they allowed the officer to take the blood. Now, of course, it won it, but I think the law as far as NCIC being reliable could still go toward this case. Further, mistake of fact could also work here. I cited Heinen versus North Carolina in my brief, and that's a case out of the U.S. Supreme Court from last October. And in that case, they found that a search or seizure may be permissible even though the justification for the act includes a reasonable factual mistake. And in that case, they made an illustration that I think is good for this case. They said that if an officer sees someone driving down an HOV lane and they only see one person in the car, they can pull them over. If they go and they see that there's two kids in the back seat, they didn't violate that person's Fourth Amendment, but the person didn't violate the HOV law, but they didn't violate the Fourth Amendment because they were acting on the facts that they had at the time. And at this time, Officer Thornton scans a license plate. It comes up and NCIC is stolen. He calls dispatch. Dispatch confirms. Dispatch looks into their paper records and confirms. And so at this time, he has specific articulable facts that this might be a stolen car, so he pulls it over. And in this case, unlike many of the out-of-state cases that Mr. Gladden has cited, in those cases it was for probable cause and they arrest the person on stolen vehicle. In this case, it's just for reasonable suspicion. And in this case, they got him out of the car to see if there was, it's supported by the record, they went into the car to see if there's any more evidence that the car was stolen. I think the officer said something, or maybe the report said something about looking for evidence that they had started the car illegally or something of that effect. And when they got into the car is when they found the drugs. And the appellant here was arrested for the drugs, not for the stolen vehicle. Going to the collective knowledge and cooperating officers argument that Mr. Gladden made, he cites no Texas law that this collective knowledge will come back the other way and would apply in this situation. Although, as stated in the state's brief, Brown versus State out of Dallas from 1999 had a similar case with a stolen vehicle. In NCIC, the vehicle came up stolen, and they found that that was later erroneous, but they still upheld the stop because it's not necessary for the NCIC database to be accurate on every occasion. In Lissy versus State, that was the one with the second DWI that was also mistaken NCIC, that was, the stop was still upheld, or the blood draw was still upheld. And in Kelly versus State, a 1986 case out of Houston, the initial detention was also based on an erroneous stolen vehicle information from NCIC. And in that case held that a reasonable suspicion may be based on articulable facts, even if such facts are ultimately shown to be inaccurate. So I think there is a lot of Texas law, and some of it specifically dealing with NCIC information that's erroneous, that where stops on reasonable suspicion have been upheld. On the other hand, the cases that appellant is citing are out-of-case cases, none have been cited by Texas, all of them are dealing with probable cause. And as cited in my brief, there's also several out-of-state cases where they've held the exact opposite. There's a couple cases, Anderson out of Ohio from 2007, that specifically criticizes and declines to follow two of the cases that appellant cites. There's another case, Whitman from 2005 out of Tennessee, where they specifically find that erroneous computer information can be enough for a reasonable suspicion stop. And as in my brief, Childress, Riley, Patterson, Lee, Town, they all find that it's reasonable to rely on inaccurate information. Appellant also argued, and he argued in his reply brief, that these aren't facts that were later proven erroneous. The state would argue that that's exactly what they were to Officer Thornton. Officer Thornton was not part of Denton Police Department. He was not cooperating with officers that have recovered this vehicle. Appellant wants every police agency and every officer to be some kind of Borg entity that can know what every other officer thinks. And I don't think that that would be reasonable, especially when they're an officer on the street is seeing a stolen vehicle. They should have the authority to pull them over for reasonable suspicion, especially when NCIC has been proven through case law to be accurate and reliable. Here, Officer Thornton relied on the information that him and Ms. Kilbrew had at the time of the stop, and that's that the car was stolen. And they reasonably relied on that because NCIC is reasonably trustworthy, and they pulled over appellant. If there's no more questions, I'll conclude. The stop here it's about reasonableness. It was reasonable for Officer Thornton to rely on this NCIC information, and the state prays that this court uphold the trial court's ruling. Thank you.
Richard?
First of all, it's pretty clear to me the state's argument is that the Supreme Court did not recognize a collective knowledge doctrine in Hensley when it said the validity of a stop is not determined by the personal knowledge of the officer making the seizure. It's determined by the information and whether or not the information he relied on in making the stop was valid, accurate, or not. The state is trying to isolate the analysis to what Officer Thornton reasonably believed. That is exactly the opposite of what the decision in Hensley, the U.S. Supreme Court decision, as well as Whiteley before it said. I would refer the court to the authority of the treaties that I cite in footnote 36, which is a Lefebvre search and seizure, two different volumes, volume 2 and volume 5, where he goes at length to discuss all the decisional law around the country dealing with exactly this issue. And it's about 30 pages of stuff, and he, that is Professor Lefebvre and Professor Baum, both make very clear that in circumstances like this, there is a constitutional violation, and that you cannot find a stop valid by isolating your analysis to, in this case, Officer Thornton's reasonable or unreasonable belief. It's the reasonableness of the officer or the error that was made in not withdrawing the NCIC report once the Denton Police Department and its officers knew that the vehicle had been recovered. It's not a question, to some extent there may be arguments in other cases under other facts that there's a tenuous causal connection between the detention and the false or knowingly false information, as in this case, prior to the stop. So for example, if you had other grounds to stop my client, it would kind of be a harmless error kind of situation, and you couldn't show that there is a direct causal link between the constitutional error and failing to withdraw the warrant or the report of a stolen vehicle and the stop. In this case, it's very clear, and in response to the question that was asked, this officer, Thornton, had no grounds at all. There was no traffic violation, no speeding, no nothing. And he just was idly running people's driver's licenses along I-35W going north, south, when my client was south of Denton, going through someplace near North Lake, Texas. And it was solely on the basis of the false report of that vehicle continuing to be stolen that my client was stopped. So there's not any lack of a direct causal link between the error, the constitutional error, and my client's detention. So that is a different, our situation is different than some of the cases the state is referring to. The analogy to the question about the HOV lane, I think, and the state has said that if an officer reasonably believes that someone is violating the HOV lane from his perceptions, if it turns out later that he's wrong, his perceptions are inaccurate, that would not be a constitutional violation. This is a situation where if the officer stopped somebody and looked in the car and determined there were two people in the car and then let them drive 100 yards and stopped them a second time to determine whether or not they still had two people in the car when the vehicle had been in his presence the whole time, that's this situation. They knew that that vehicle had been recovered. And that officer, whether it's the officer or the dispatcher that fouled things up, or the system of hiding from the dispatcher, the fact in the computer system the dispatcher didn't have access to, it's an error of constitutional magnitude because it was unreasonable, and either as a matter of policy or unreasonable on the failures by those officers at the Denton Police Department. And if this isn't a constitutional violation, it certainly would create a situation where you could have, in other situations, a deliberate concealment of known vehicles that were no longer stolen, and that would just allow the police department to ad infinitum pull over any vehicle that's ever been reported stolen, regardless of whether it's ever been recovered or not. So I submit to you, and the state's conceded that Article 38.23, the trial court erred, so you're just focusing on whether the collective knowledge applies to include in the analysis the information that was held by the Denton Police Department. And I think it certainly does, as Professor Lefebvre and Professor Baum both state at length in their legal treaties, which I think is the most widely recognized search and seizure treaties in the country. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your argument. Your case is submitted. And since you are the last case of the day, you're free to go about your business. There's nobody to stay around.